Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim Dennis will join me a little later for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Doing the show has been cathartic for me in a lot of ways. As I've mentioned to some of the listeners over the years, what really brought me to true crime, unfortunately, was my own life having been touched by true crime. My first high school girlfriend had been brutally murdered, and her unborn child had been removed from her womb and stolen by three conniving monsters that wanted to steal her baby and left her in a pool of blood with her other young son sitting there, and murdered two of her other children. And that's where my interest in the field of true crime came in, trying to understand why people do the things they do. What is it that separates you from me, that separates me from Richard Speck or John Gacy or any of these other strange cases of people who've had a lot of similar backgrounds as you read about them? Not every serial killer was a bedwetter, fire starter, animal abuser. Sometimes they just have a broken mind. But when you read about them, you find that some of these killers, these people are just like you. And what is it? What's the turn of the screw that separates them? And that's been a big part of this process for me in interviewing all of these amazing authors, survivors, and more about these cases, is trying to get a handle on it and an understanding, which I think is why many of you listen to this show and watch the plethora of programming on TV. We're fascinated by the evil that men and women do, and for what purpose? Today's story is very important to me as well, because another big part of my history and another part of where I see myself going from one end of the spectrum to the other. I grew up in Illinois, Roselle, Illinois, and I was bullied pretty much from first grade through the middle part of fourth grade, mercilessly. I got my ass handed to me almost daily on the way home from school. Punches, kicks, shoves, you name it. Name calling, made to feel horrible. And I remember, you know, third and fourth grade thinking of self-harm, thinking of doing horrific things to myself and to others just to end the torture of bullying. It's still hard at the age of 50 years old to talk about that in some cases. Luckily, I had a mom who championed for me. She came and she saw what happened to me. She saw that it wasn't just a child looking for attention and blowing a mountain out of a molehill. And she moved me and brought me to a different school that restructured my life and started me off in a new way that was more supportive and filled with love and friendship. Not everybody is that lucky. And today we're going to talk about a very topical story. I know a lot of the stories we've covered recently have been wartime stories and the roaring 20s or 30s, some into the 1800s, some of the modern day serial killers. This story is a different story. On September 5th of 2015, in a very public park in Tennessee, a 14-year-old girl carried out a horrific moment that ended her life. Judith A. Yates is the author of the book Bullied to Death, A Story of Bullying, Social Media, and the Suicide, I hope I pronounce this properly, of Cherokee Harriman. Our guest this evening is a criminologist. She's the award-winning author of When Nashville Bled and The Devil You Know, and she's the editor of True Crime Case Files magazine. We'll put a link up to that on today's show. You want to subscribe, you want to get this magazine. They have some of the best talent involved in this magazine. She's appeared on numerous talk shows, has lectured, conducted training, and made guest speaking appearances across the United States. And after a lifetime of working in law enforcement, Ms. Yates lives in Kentucky. She's here with us for this evening. Thank you so much for joining us, Judith.
Well, thank you for asking me. And you're right, it is a very timely topic. And I think everyone, you know, whether they read the book or not, needs to be educated on these facts and on the fallacies and on this topic.
You know, bullying is bullying. It's been the same thing through centuries, but it seems that it's taken on an epidemic to epidemic proportions, and it's become viral in the sense that people that normally may not have ever been bullies have become bullies. And I don't like to point the finger always at social media, but I feel that that's kind of where we're at in this world. It's so easy to sit behind our computer screens, Judith, and say hateful, vitriol, and venomous things to one another because we don't have to face them anymore. We don't have to look into their eyes to realize, oh, these things are hateful. They're hurtful. Look at the pain I've caused that person by saying this. There's a social disconnect that's taken place in our society. Bullying, I think, is at a much more rampant, violent place than it probably ever has been in our culture. Am I over-exaggerating this thought because of my own past, or is this what you're finding as well?
Well, you've got so many factors going on here. And first of all, I do want to say I'm not a doctor. I'm a criminologist. I spent 3+ years writing and researching this book, so I can tell you what I found. And, you know, this case opened my eyes in so many different ways on this topic. And one of the things that I have always preached was, you know, we're always looking for something to blame when a tragedy happens. It was guns. It was social media. It was, you know, driving while texting. It was this, it was that. And there is no one reason ever when a crime happens. Nothing happens in a vacuum, you know. Social media is easy to blame. You know, it's a machine. It can't fight back. It's a cell phone. It can't fight back. So it's very easy to blame. And we always want something to blame. And anything new, technology, trends, et cetera, is going to bring both positive and negative consequences. That's just how life works. And we can say, oh, kids these days, but you have to think, you know, ancient Romans, ancient Greeks, you were lucky to live to be 20. There were some children not so long ago that feared for their lives, you know, because they were Jewish, because they were Romanian. And then not so long ago, there were children who were taught to duck and cover under their desks should a nuclear bomb land. So each generation grew up under the fear of something because of the times.
And I understand that aspect of it. I understand that we've evolved and grown through times of fear and hatred and retribution. But it seems now people have turned away from one another within their own cultures even. You know, I mean, a lot of these things you could say in the past, you know, was people pitted against one culture against another, one belief system, one religion, whatever, one social level against another. Now it seems that even your contemporaries, there's this really cancerous anger that has grown amongst people, and it's really shown its ugly head in the last 2 years specifically. And like you, I understand we want to place the point of blame on something. We want to see that, you know, hey, this is a thing that we need to fix. And the internet and social media is an easy platform to say that about. But I do think that there's a lot of weight on that as well, because people of like mind, you know, these dark minds sometimes find each other and they gang up and they start seeing what's happening. And we're hearing these bullying stories more and more where kids, teenagers are horrific. I mean, I could never imagine having been told when I was a kid, you should kill yourself because you made that mistake. You're a failure and a loser. You should kill yourself, from one person. Not saying that that wouldn't happen, but to hear it from entire communities and clusters of children from the same school, that's what's so unbelievable to me. And we hear these stories on a more and more basis, on a regular basis, Judith. That's really terrifying.
One of the problems we're doing with this that I've noted is we're relying on reports from the media. And, you know, I work for the media. You work for the media. I'm not saying all media. I'm saying specific reports from the media that we're being told. For example, there was a little girl that when she did commit suicide, it was reported, well, people were telling her, oh, go drink bleach and kill yourself. Another boy said, well, then why don't you go kill yourself? But nobody mentioned that she continually reported on her Facebook, I hate myself, I'm going to kill myself, a constant stream of posts And other kids were telling her, oh, please don't do this. We love you. We're your friends. Call me if you need to talk to me. And one kid would post, and why don't you go drink bleach? That one post was reported, not the 10, 12, 15 posts of her friends saying, don't do it. We love you. Seek help. Come talk to me. You see where I'm going with that?
I do. I understand that. And
so
and,
that's where we're
right.
going. And another issue is we're lumping, you know, we're lumping bullying, teasing, and joking all together now. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. Bullying does exist. Certainly. And part of the problem, too, is our defining bullying. Every school district has its own definition. Every school has its own definition. And according to one researcher, there are actually three definitions. And that's, again, part of the problem is what is bullying? Is it shoving someone in the hall? Is it being called, hey, skinny stick? Is it saying, ooh, you really, you know, screwed up the game that time? Is it having food dumped down your shirt? Is it someone teasing someone because they got a haircut? Exactly what is bullying? You know, and I've, you know, all of us have been bullied, teased, joked with. It was school. Kids are mean is the bottom line. You know, we're especially in high school. I taught high school. I never will again. Kids are mean, and they're trying to find themselves. They're in that space between a child and an adult. Hormones are raging. The boundaries, the borderlines of who and what we are, as well as the rules or lack thereof. You know, you got things going on at home. You've got this whole boyfriend-girlfriend thing. You've got school. Kids are caught in that vortex, and they're finding themselves, and it comes out in their behavior. And it comes out in their negative behavior, in their positive behavior, and that's how they treat one another. And so I had kids coming up to me. I was bullied, Miss Yates. What did they say to you? They made fun of me because I wore glasses. Hey, four eyes. And then I had kids coming, you know, I was bullied. Well, what happened to you? They shoved me into a locker. You know, there's a striking difference there. So
there's a striking difference in the fact of how the bullying was carried out. But do you not see that in both senses, those are forms of bullying, whether you're demeaning somebody's self-worth because of their looks or the things, you know, independent things about them, or physically taking measures against that person, whether it's shoving them into a locker, beating them up in the locker room at school, beating them up after school. There's different aspects to the bullying, but psychologically, children kind of grow and mature at different ages and different stages. Bullying can be just as impactful with words as it can be with physical altercations.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And, you know, when I looked at this whole story and I looked at this whole research, I saw that, you know, bullying is dangerous. It's degrading. It's illegal behavior. It's discriminatory behavior. Shoving downstairs, pouring food on their head, just horrific name calling. And I don't mean like skinny or, haircut, making fun of somebody's haircut. I mean, ugly. Sexual abuse, sexual, you know, grabbing someone where they shouldn't be grabbing. And then I looked at the teasing aspect of it. You know, over a grade, one comment over a grade, one comment over somebody wearing eyeglasses. You know, and we've got to find somewhere in the system what is the bullying, what is the teasing, because we have to set the parameters, we have to set the boundaries over what is teasing, what is bullying. Is it a one-time comment over a grade? Ha ha, I got an A, you got a D. One-time comment or the constant, what are you stupid? You always make D's. I always make A's. You need to belong in the, you know, special class, et cetera, et cetera. So you see where I'm going with this is we've got to define what is bullying, what is joking, what is teasing. There's a difference.
I agree completely with you. That there is definitely a difference in. And we've watched it. It is funny, though, as humans, right? You and I could be best of friends. And I tell you, hey, nice dress. Where'd you pick it up? At Goodwill? And you can go, knock it off, you jerk, and we'll laugh about it. But somebody else comes up to you that day and goes, that has got to be the ugliest dress I've ever seen. What, was there a fire sale at Salvation Army? And all of a sudden, we're wounded by that.
Exactly.
Right? Isn't that funny how, you know, as long as it's being said by somebody we love and care about in a joking manner, we can absorb it. Or sometimes it's said, you know, with caring and compassion from somebody you love, that's like, oh, I don't know if that outfit's right for you, Judith. Maybe you should go change. And you take that as a form of bullying, but your friends can ride you about it when you get to school. We are a strange people because we don't have one defined line of what's right and what's wrong. There's all that shades of gray.
That's what I'm saying is, right. You know, we're kind of lumping it all together, you know, and I could go to the principal and say, you bullied me. You made fun of my clothes and said I was poor and ugly and skinny. And you know, I need to change my clothes because I smell, because I shop at the Salvation Army. And you see where I'm at with that.
Right.
What
brought your attention to this story? Of all the true crimes that are going on out there and the horrific things that people do to one another, why did her story stand out to you so much?
You know, I don't choose the cases I write about. They choose me. And it was really one of the worst times because I was already working on my last book, which is She Is Evil, Case in Memphis. And this case about Cherokee made the local headlines like gangbusters. And of course, it was September 2015, and I sort of glanced at it. And I thought, what is this beautiful, sweet-faced little girl taking her own life? My God, she was only 14. You know, her horrifically sad. And I don't read anything while I'm working on a book. I don't read anything. I don't pay attention to the news. Well, it just kept poking me in the shoulder. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. And I was like, look, I don't have time for anything right now. I'm researching this. I'm working on the magazine. I'm winding up this book. And it just kept poking me in the shoulder. I'm here. I'm here. Okay, I will read something about it. And that led to, okay, I'll keep this magazine clip. Okay, I'll go to City Hall for this one meeting about, you know, bullying in kids. Okay, and it just sort of manifested itself.
Kind
and
of
I
evolved.
Could not stop looking. Yes, I mean, I couldn't stop looking at this little girl's picture thinking, you know, what the hell is this kid doing, especially the way she did it?
Before we get into that then, let's go back into her life, all right?
Okay.
She took her life at, what was it, the age of 14?
She was 14.
Well, talk to me about her life leading up to that. I mean, did she have a pretty normal life that you're able to put together? Was this a systemic issue that had been a part of her life since, you know, younger years? What can you tell me?
Cherokee's life was typical of these kids that are committing bullicide. And again, you don't hear this. You only hear the fact that they killed themselves because they were quote unquote bullied. Cherokee had a tough life. She had some mental illness. She had some personality disorder, some problems in the home, problems at school. And, you know, I should back up with that. The learning disorder, the problems at the home, all kind of led to problems at school and her social awkwardness. So it all sort of happened together, if that makes sense. It all kind of one begat the other. She had been sexually abused when she was very, very young. And she had been put on medication at a very, very young age. Typical of sexually abused children, she was fire setting, destroying property. As she got older, she was acting out. She didn't want to go to school. So there was truancy involved. There was refusing to attend school. And Cherokee came from a lower socioeconomic family. Now, they were doing the absolute best they could on what they had. And Cherokee, you know, like her peers, she wanted nice things, not necessarily expensive things, just pretty things, little bracelets, trinkets, and she was stealing them. It was the only way she knew how to get them. And so she was getting in trouble in school for that. When it all came to a head, she was put in a mental health hospital. She sort of bounced in and out mental health facilities until their insurance ran out, from my understanding. Her grades were going up and down in school. Sometimes she was just barely passing, but they still passed her. She was not doing well in schools. Now, here's the rub. When she was in the mental health facility with very small classes and individual attention, she excelled. She was making A's and B's. But when she went into the public system, her grades were C's and B's at the very, very best, which she was scraping by with some classes.
And we hear that a lot with kids, right? I mean, when they get that more of that focus attention, they do flourish, which is kind of a shame with our current school systems that the teacher seems so overloaded and the children aren't being gleaned into this educational system in a better way.
Right. It's, you know, no child left behind, and it's get them through, pass them through at any cost, teach to the test. And what I thought was interesting when I looked over her grade reports is it showed in one class she was doing very poorly, but on her test results overall, she was doing well. So her grades looked very scattered across the board, and they were still passing her. She was overtly emotional. She's a very emotional little girl. And yet Cherokee was such a good-hearted little girl. She was such a good friend to the few friends that she had. She was boy crazy, which comes with being that age. Unfortunately, she also saw boys as almost a life raft. I think she was looking for that unconditional love, you know, boyfriend will love me forever. Even though her very best friends were telling Cherokee, this is a boyfriend. You're 13, you're 12, it's not going to last forever. But she thought, oh, well, this is the boy I'm going to marry, and we'll have kids, and we'll be in love forever, just like, you know, Cinderella or Snow White. She loved her family very, very much. And I can say her family adored this little girl. She was surrounded by love. And she loved doing makeup and hair and nails. She excelled at it. She would see a YouTube video one time, and she could do these extraordinary hair do's, just these hair, the braiding and the, you know, she was so good at it. And nails, she was just extraordinary at this talent. And she had told people she wanted to open up her own salon. And when she was able, the school had a special program for cosmetology. And she couldn't wait until she was in the right grade where she could actually take that course. So she was so pumped about that. And she was. She was just a sweetheart of a kid. But then she also had that side of her where with the chemical imbalance, she would have those temper tantrums. And she could act very childish. And she couldn't control her emotions. And so kids just thought she was the weirdo or the, you know, the poor kid who smelled bad and, you know, the bratty kid. And they thought she was weird. So they would tease her until she would just explode because it's just so much fun to tease her. Boy, look, you know, we'll get her riled now. And that was part of the bullying.
Ugh. How did it begin? Again, was it a slow crawl of bullying as she got older, or was it really that grade things started to step up and get, you know, get to the boiling point for her?
You mean as far as the day that she met the kids in the park, or?
Right. I mean, had it been that year that things were really coming to a head, or had it been, you know, kind of stretched out over the last 2 or 3 years?
I believe it was always something.
Okay.
There was always something because part of the problem was, and this is again typical of children who have been sexually molested, she was afraid to bathe or you know, she had an issue with hygiene, taking care of herself. The family was not rich, so they couldn't afford, you know, all the fancy clothing and name brands. You know, she didn't have the big fancy cell phone or iPad or iThis or iThat that all the other kids had. So she was made fun of for how she dressed, how she looked. You know, they called her stinky. There was a lot of smoking cigarettes going on in the household, so I'm sure that had something to do with it.
All right.
She was, yeah, she, you know, there was always something to tease Cherokee about. She loved cutting her own hair and styling it. She was very good at it. But then somebody always had something to say about that. You look right. like a boy. You can see your roots. Just always something to say to her.
It, you know, that, and let me just address listeners too. Talk to your kids. You know, I do it with mine on a regular basis, and it's something that's important. Just common courtesy. There's nicer ways to teach your children how to say things. And just help them understand that sometimes if, you know, to stop and think before they open their mouth. And something that they may think is just a throwaway comment or something, just think about the impact of the words that you're about to say. And how that may affect somebody. And you never know how that person's day has been going already and what it may be that is the final push that sends them to hurt themselves or sends them home to get a gun and come back and hurt you and others. We don't know what that balance is anymore. But if we teach more courtesy, more loving and understanding, less of this problem will happen. And I know that's this utopian version of the world I'm hoping for, Judith, but you know, it starts at home. We have to start teaching kids that this is there's other ways to handle our thoughts and conveying messages that don't have to be hurtful or mean-spirited. You know, that's the part that kind of really sticks in my craw because I watch that across the board. The older I get, you'd think people in my age range would even be better at this. And I just watch how callous people are and how rude they are. And I don't know that they're necessarily doing it out of malice or anger, but you listen to the way people speak to each other in general, and we're just not a very nice group of beings, you know? I've watched it in my own life. I'll bump into guys I haven't seen since high school, and I'll be generally happy, and I'll be, wow, God, it is so good to see you guys. How are you? Hey, Schrader, did you miss any lunches in the last 30 years? And you think, you know, not that I'm acting like a wounded child here, but those moments stick to me simply out of the idea of where is the, you know, 30 years has passed, you're seeing somebody, wouldn't it be about, man, great to see you, this is what's going on in my life, instead of watching people tear each other down.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's, I don't know what's going on in the world, and maybe it's always been a part of the world. It's just, it's disturbing to me what lack of common courtesy and sense people have. And instead of pointing fingers, you know, maybe at social media and things like that, it's more about that's the real systemic problem is we just don't care how other people feel. All we care about is our thoughts and our, you know, what's in our mind at that moment. And nobody takes time to actually think through the words that they're about to say to somebody.
I'm not sure if, you know, unfortunately we only see the bad because it sticks out of the general or of the good. I'm not sure. And, you know, everybody wants, I'm telling you right now, everybody wants to bring right away. It's the parents' fault. Where was her parents? Why wasn't her parents involved? Cherokee's parents were as involved in her life as they could be.
Sure.
And her mother is a very, very kind person. Her mother, Heather, does not discriminate. She loved Heather. She loved Cherokee very much. And she would tell Cherokee, the girls are just jealous because you're a very pretty girl, which is true. And she would tell Cherokee, do not be mean to other people, to be kind. You know, again, people are always going to tell you how you could live your life better.
Right.
And what they would have done. Well, where were the parents? Well, where was the school? Well, why didn't the teachers? That is not fair. Now, her parents, who were very open and honest with me, They were just a joy to work with. Her mother has told me herself she regrets a lot of things she did as a parent. And she also told me things that she felt she did wrong. And one of the things that I was so touched by with Cherokee's parents and family was they were bitterly honest with me, which means they were bitterly honest with that child.
Right.
And Cherokee could have dated, could have been boyfriend or girlfriend with, you know, men, people from another country, black and Jewish, it did not matter. Her mother believed as long as this person treated my daughter right, they were welcome in my house. She just did not believe in discriminating. She did not believe in being
right.
hateful.
What I was referring to when I was addressing adults was the fact that, you know, if we started home talking to our kids about how to treat others, I was meaning
exactly.
more along the lines of just doing that, not necessarily calling out the parents of these children that are involved. Because as you pointed, sometimes they're doing the best they can. I know. Listen, I have children that I love. And as a father of 8 children, I love my children unconditionally. Some of them are just jerks. And that may make me go down as the worst dad, but at least I can admit it. And I have to have conversations.
Exactly.
And I'm like, that's not the way to treat somebody. Don't talk to people like that. Don't do. And it shocks them sometimes. They're like, well, that's how everybody talks at school. And I'm like, don't be everybody. Don't be unkind. You know, take the high road every chance you get to just do the right thing. And my kids have good hearts, but I just think we've lost the common, a lot of the world has lost the common decency angle of conversation. They don't know how to converse. Everything has got to be a shot at one another. Everything's got to be, you know, whether you're trying to do it in jest or whatever to, you know, ingratiate yourself into their lives. It just, it's a weird place people are in at this point. And I wish I wish I had a better handle on understanding that. But these kids. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I think that's the point. What I meant is her family taught her, despite all her problems, to treat people well. And she was a sweet girl. She was a sweet girl to her friends. And she was a very, you know, every friend of Cherokee's told me she was such a good listener. She never judged us, and she was so kind. You know, when she was able to, she was so kind and good to people. And so she learned that from them. As bad as she was treated, she still learned those basic values. So that tells me something.
Do me a favor here. Set the stage. What led us to this moment in her life on that day? What was different about that day than any other that led her to take her own life?
Well, Laverne, Tennessee is a small town near Nashville, and there's a small park there called Mankin Park, and it was near Cherokee's house. And she would go there sometimes just to kind of be alone and think things through and just sort of, you know, have her own space. So she walked to Mankin Park, and there were a few kids her age there at the park, one of which was a boy that she used to date. And one of the kids was his current girlfriend. And the other kids she did not know. So she sat down on a swing set. One of the girls that she didn't know came over to talk to her. And she started to leave the park. Well, another one of the kids started yelling at her and name calling. So Cherokee answers back and she says, I don't even know you. Oh, yeah, well, you're this, you're that. You better shut up. No, you better shut up. And it went back and forth. And the girl's friends are saying, look, leave it alone. Just quit. And the girl kind of gets a taste of it. So she's yelling, just name calling in exchange of, oh, yeah, you're a bigger one. So Cherokee leaves. The other kids go back to the park. Cherokee goes home. She sort of slips into the kitchen. Her sister's in the living room. She gets a kitchen knife. She slips past her sister, goes back to the park, and she's hidden the knife in her jacket. The kids are still there at the pavilion talking, and they see her. Now, it's really sort of a gray area as to what happened. But basically, Cherokee yelled at the kids, so you want to call me names. They looked over, and she had stabbed herself. She raised her fist over her head with a knife in her fist. And when they looked, she punched herself in the gut and stabbed herself in the stomach. And again, there's kind of a gray area as far as who did what, because there are several different reports. She was rushed to the hospital, and she subsequently passed because she had bled out internally. And the local media ran with it, calling it a bullicide, meaning she killed herself because the kids had bullied her. The word bullicide was used again and again. It made a big story locally. I believe it was also internationally in some places. And she gained a lot of attention. One of her family members started a nonprofit organization. They wanted bullying to be declared illegal in Tennessee. They're still working on that endeavor. And her family went to the city hall meeting in an attempt to make her case be known and to talk to the city officials about making bullying illegal. And it was just a very, very sad, horrific case. The law enforcement investigated the case and determined that it was not bullying. It was a fight over a boy. Closed the case. And the coroner ruled suicide, which meant that none of the hospital bills were covered by insurance. So it bankrupted her caregivers.
Because it's a suicide, it doesn't get covered, or just because the family didn't
Correct.
Have insurance?
No, it's not covered by insurance.
I didn't know that. Is that a regular part of most medical insurances?
Well, they were covered by states. It's called TennCare here in Tennessee.
Okay.
They were covered by state insurance.
Wow. So it's the ultimate double whammy. Mm-hmm. Family loses their child to something horrific, and then there's no support afterwards, and none of it's taken care
Correct.
Of or covered.
Correct. Wow. So it's sort of, you know, to me, Cherokee's story was really, you know, everybody thinks of bullying as the mean kids in the schoolyard picking on the weak kid in the schoolyard, where one thing that I saw was the system bullying us or people, i.e. the medical care system. And then I got to thinking about the school system itself bullying the staff and the students and the parents, because they're so underfunded, they're so overstaffed. And when Cherokee went into the mental health hospital, from reading reports, from interviewing people, she felt bullied because they wanted her to talk about this. They wanted her to, you know, tell how she felt about that. And she didn't want to talk about it. So in her mind, they're bullying her to talk about her feelings and what she thought about this and tell them what happened here. You know, they just wanted her to talk and talk and talk, and she didn't want to talk. So really, bullying was not just Cherokee being bullied by these mean kids. It was a system bullying the people, bullying the family, bullying Cherokee, and it kind of all fed off of itself.
When this case goes to court, I mean, and they're looking at it a bully aside, I mean, how does the court start to even look at that? Is that something that, you know, if somebody is bullied, but you take your own life, how is that being looked at through the court systems in the United States this day? Is there enough that if somebody is telling you to do it or encouraging you to do it or making you feel so bad that you do it, that then you become like an accessory to the crime?
this case will never go to court. And that was one of the issues that the family had. Law enforcement gathered the evidence, presented it to the district attorney, who said this was a fight over a boy. It wasn't a crime. And bullicide is considered not a crime because how are you going to prove that the bullies caused a person to take their lives?
I get that to a degree. That's where it's really kind of sad, because it is a hard line to draw again. Where is the edge of that principle when you're talking about what drives somebody to do something like this? There was that big story I was going to mention that just took place, I think, in the last year here, where the girl talking to her boyfriend ended up telling him, yeah, you should kill yourself. I want to hear it and blah, blah, blah. Let me know when you're going to do it. And she kind of cajoled him into this position, death by text or suicide by text kind of situation. And there you've got somebody that's actually pushing for it to occur and to happen.
Did she, or was she joking? And here we go again.
Right.
Julian versus joking.
I'm sorry, you're getting a little muffled on me. We're getting a strange clicking noise, and you're kind of muffled. I don't know if we're losing connection, right? But and I get that as well. That's where it gets dodgy. But if you know, where do you stand on this? I mean, you obviously know a lot about criminology and the way that people work. If I was able to sit down with your child and talk them into killing themselves, should I be held culpable for that? Or because, no, your child had all the right in the world to say, screw you, Dave Schrader, I'm not going to do that, and walk away. Should there be some kind of culpability to the people that are influencing those lives? Or then do we run into the very hard line like with Marilyn Manson and the Columbine murders? You know, do we now hold Marilyn Manson legally responsible for the shootings that took place in Columbine because they were quoting Marilyn Manson lyrics and they were, that was kind of their allegiance to that ideal? Should that person then be held responsible for the damage that they do under the name of, you know, would Charles Manson then be held, should the Beatles be held responsible because of the Helter Skelter message that he felt that they were trying to pass on to him? That can get into a real tumultuous and dangerous situation, couldn't it?
Okay, side note, those kids didn't listen to Marilyn Manson.
Right, but that was the big news story at the
I'm
time.
I'm sorry, but that was a sign.
Right, that was the whole thing that they were talking about, is that there was this influence of this music on these people. And that's what I'm just saying, is that's where the danger would lie. If we start to draw a line and say, yes, if there's an influencer in making this decision, then where do we start holding that line? Do we hold Shakespeare responsible for young teenage murder suicides because that was it? I mean, you do have to take some stance to say, no, people still have free will and an understanding to do things on their own. But is there moments when people are pushed that we should look at that and judge them on that aspect?
Right. And as I was saying a while ago, you know, the kid that, you know, where they were saying, oh, well, one kid told her, well, why don't you just drink bleach and end it all? Okay, well, let's look at the other 20 or so posts where they were saying, no, you can talk to me. Don't do it. We're your friends. Please seek help. I'm coming over to your house. Should we hold that one person responsible? He said, oh, look, I'm tired of listening to you. Just drink bleach. You know, is that person? And again, as you said, we could go as far back as Aristotle, or we could go back as far to the beginning of time, to the Bible, and say, okay, we're going to hold the Bible responsible for you beating your wife or you being mean to your child or what have you. It's just not possible.
In my opinion, it is
just not possible.
So in cases where they're, you know, the girl's video got out of her undressing for her boyfriend and everybody started calling a whore and a slut and she should kill herself. And if I were you, I'd kill myself. And people are doing that mercilessly, even though there are people that are good. If you're already in an unhinged and an emotional state, you know, doesn't that then start to preclude the fact that, you know, you're messing with somebody, you're psychologically messing with somebody who's in a fragile or unbalanced nature?
Right. I think there should be some kind of sanction. I truly believe that. but I'm not looking at this from an emotional point. I'm looking at it from a law point.
Right, and I understand
because
that.
Because that's how we have to look at it.
But wasn't like...
I think there needs to be some kind of a sanction, but I can't say that they can be held responsible for murder because it does not meet the statute.
The movie that Jodie Foster did back in the late 80s, early 90s, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, where she gets brutally raped in the bar by a few men.
Yes, The Accused.
Yes, The Accused. The idea in that was that they went after the people that were there in the bar watching it take place and cheering these guys on. Correct? So weren't they eventually found kind of culpable for that action as well because they were goading the rapists into doing what they were doing and taking turns? I would think that would have set some kind of precedent in law that this type of thing would be looked at a little bit more generally, or has that been dismissed since?
I couldn't tell you. I really don't. You know, I wish I was more well versed in these in these situations. You know, again, I wish I were. And law is not the legal side isn't my strongest suit, I should say. And I can tell you from a criminologist point of view. I can tell you from opinion point of view. I think there should be sanctions. But again, legally, we can't say it was rape. We can't say it was murder. We can't say it was attempted murder. But I do believe there should be some kind of sanctions for the situations. Now, in Cherokee's case, there's simply no proof. There's simply nothing to charge these kids with. It was a verbal altercation. These kids did not know Cherokee's background. All they knew was something about, you know, you stole my man, you can't have him, he's mine, oh yeah, you're a bitch, blah, 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 back and forth. That's all they knew.
And I keep saying I understand. I do understand the principles of the law and how delicate a situation this would be to mobilize and change, because, again, then we run into the parameters of what defines this law, what defines culpability on these people's behalf. And what it really just comes down to is people just need to start to learn to be more kind to one another, more understanding, and stop the vitriol and hatred. But that, I guess, will never happen. It has never stopped since the days of the Bible and the earliest ramblings of man in story to today. It's just the way human nature is. We find weaknesses and we seem to play on them and pick on them you know, whether you call it teasing or playing or bullying, they have the same effect, but you don't know from person to person how that is going to affect somebody.
You know, I put it in my Facebook post, a really interesting study about how bullying has been a part of human nature literally since the beginning of time, and how it has always been a survival technique from animals to human beings, but the dynamics change. Of course, with the animals, it's a literal survival tactic. The strong getting the weak out of the tribe or out of the group, out of the herd. Whereas with human beings, it's sociological, it's mental, it's emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And the study itself was just fascinating to me because you could relate it to Cherokee's case. You could relate it, you could set it side by side to every bullicide case that has occurred in the last X number of years and do it, you know, step by step. It was very interesting that how, you know, each animal, tribe, or group has bullied the other animal to frighten it away or to keep it away in order to gain something. And that's basically what a bullying behavior is.
Has there been anybody in these bully side cases that's been found guilty?
I don't think so. I know, like you said, the recent one with the girl with the text and the guy.
Right.
And you also have to wonder how much of an impact is what's happening socially have on those cases.
Right. And the reason I brought up the one about the texting as well, I try to watch some of these stories as they unfold, and I'll watch, well, Nancy Grace attack on some of these cases, and you sit there and you listen. She's kind of like the farthest end of the spectrum to me about every criminal case, because she will just take the most, pomp and circumstance route to every one of these cases and blather on. And it astounds me. But the media takes a very responsible role in this for the way that they convey these stories. And, you know, we heard the story of that girl with the texting, and she started texting to her boyfriend, yeah, go ahead, kill yourself. No, you should just get it done. You should. And, you know, I remember turning to my wife when I was hearing about this, and we were both kind of horrified. And I said, but you know what? We don't know the context of this. If right. you've heard for the last year how I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to kill myself. Oh, I can't. You know what? You might just get to that point. We've all been to that point where you hear somebody say, oh, nobody loves me, nobody. And you're just like, yeah, you're right. Fine. Nobody loves you. The world is against you. Yeah, go ahead and kill yourself. And it's not meant as a go ahead and do it. It is a I'm tired of hearing you're bitching and whining. And there's nothing that ever mm-hmm. makes you happy. No matter what I say or what support I give you, you're continually in this downward spiral of negativity. And it starts to bleed other people's lives that aren't having that situation. And as cruel as it sounds, you know, sometimes we get to that point in our life where we're just like, okay, then do it. Have a good day. And you hang up. And does it mean you're cruel or uncaring? No, because on the other side of it, is it fair for you to keep dumping your problems on my shoulder and eating up my life and time in concern to continue to worry about you when I've got my own stuff I have to deal with? So I don't know that we'll ever see a true line of definition, as you and I have been saying, about how do we take care of these kind of cases, and what do we consider to be cases of, you know, what was the true intent? You know, but then exactly. on the other side of it, if I'm throwing a sandbag off a bridge and my intent was just to throw a sandbag off a bridge and watch it blast down on the road, and just at that moment a car sped through the bridge and it hit it and I killed the driver, my intent was just to see how the bag would react when it hit the ground, not how it would, you know, feel if it hit somebody's car and killed them. So should that kid be any less guilty of murder because that wasn't his intent? He didn't intend. Set out to murder somebody. He set out with a totally different intention.
Right. And again, there's the legal definition of murder versus manslaughter versus, and you know, that you brought up an interesting point. My little sister was dating somebody several years ago, and she finally was like, look, this is not working, because he was so negative about everything. So he curled up in the middle of her bed and said he wasn't leaving, and days he just curled up in the middle of her bed crying, sucking his thumb, and she was like, get out. Well, if I leave, I'll commit suicide. And that's all he said. And finally, Janine was like, I don't care. You know, I'm sick of this, and blah, blah, blah. And he finally left. And of course, he tells everybody that she was so mean and cold. She threw him out of the house with no clothes, no food, no shoes. And of course, Janine was looked at. And of course, they believed him because he just had the clothes on his back, no shoes, no food, no furniture. And, you know, he didn't bother to tell them what had happened. And I think about now, you know, she could have been charged with telling him to commit suicide. So, again, as you said, no one understands the context. And think about that before you go on social media. Right. Talking about what a bitch Janine was and how cold-hearted, and she should go before the judge and they should lock her up forever, you know?
Yeah, it's all of us shaking our fist in righteous indignation at how we would have handled the situation differently. And I guarantee you, at one point in everybody's life, we've all shrugged our shoulders and said, I'm done. I quit caring. I don't do whatever you're going to do, because we've all been pushed by at least one person in our life that is a continual mm-hmm. spiral of drama and tornado problems. And you just have to say, my life cannot end because this person is such a lunatic. I need to get away from this. That doesn't make you guilty by association, because then they took their lives and you didn't do something. You know, it'd be one thing if they were standing there holding a gun to their head saying, you know, take this gun from my hand, I'm going to kill myself, and you just stood there and didn't take the gun from their hand. You know, I guess then you had the opportunity to save them. But even that becomes dodgy, right? Do I take the chance that I lean forward to grab that gun and then you decide you're going to turn it on me? You know?
Right.
It seems like we're in the Kobayashi Maru, the no-win situation. You know, whatever decision you make in a lot of these ways can be held against you. But that's, again, why I think it's important we all learn more patience and common courtesy with one another. And there are ways to help people now that are dealing with this that, you know, maybe reaching out to their family members and letting people know. I had a listener a few years ago who reached out to me that said they wanted to end it. And that was it. And I looked them up and ended up finding their number and contacted them. And the wife answered and I told her, hey, I think you should be aware. This is what your husband just told me. And she said, mm-hmm. My husband's laying in bed right next to me and his mouth is open and, you know, blown away that you made this call. And I said, well, I couldn't go to sleep tonight knowing that this is where his mindset was. And she said, thanks for bringing this to our attention. We'll get through this. And, you know, I got a nice follow-up email afterwards from the listener saying, you know, I was shocked and horrified that you would make that phone call, but it was the best thing that could have ever happened because I was able to talk to my wife for the first time and talk about what the problems were. So sometimes we can reach out and we can do something to help. And, you know, it's that line of when do we interfere and when don't we? What, you know, could I have been sued for contacting his wife with that private information? I'm not an attorney. I'm not a psychologist. So I guess there's no, you know, client privilege kind of thing going on there. I don't know. We're in a weird world right now.
I think we can do all we can do. I had a good friend of Cherokee's writing some stuff on his social media. And that's one of the reasons social media is in the title, because these kids write down everything on their Facebook and tweets. And he was writing some really scary stuff on his Facebook. And I contacted his mom and I said, I just want to let you know this guy is worrying me and I can't say anything because I'm an adult and he is legally a child. And she thanked me for bringing it to his attention and they got him help. Because again, multiple studies have shown when a bullying situation occurs, it doesn't just affect the kid bullied. It affects the bully and it affects those who have observed the bullying. Now, one of the kids who was there that day that Cherokee killed herself and watched, who wasn't involved in the name calling exchange, they were posting some really scary things on Facebook. So I contacted their parents and I said, I want you to know this person is writing this. Well, I didn't get a response. So I contacted every adult on that person's Facebook page, friends, and said, this person is putting this really scary stuff in there and they really got me worried. And the only thing I got back was it's been taken care of. And they're still, you know, every now and then posting some really scary stuff. And then they they unfriended me. And that's the last I heard. And I tried to contact Friends of Cherokee. I've tried to contact, you know, some of the people that were there that day. And I was told by parents, we need to just forget about this and move on with our lives. You know, these were kids that observed and witnessed and were there trying to save a kid's life because she committed suicide. So we just need to forget about it. And that really bothers me. I think it'll bother me.
Sweep it under the carpet life. Because it's easier to forget and not talk about it mm-hmm. than it is to deal with the awkwardness of the entire situation.
Right. And I had these kids private messaging me saying, so do you really want to know what happened? Or do you really, you know, I need to ask you, I need to talk to you. And I would explain to them, I've got to talk to your parents first. And I would send them private message, give this to your parents. You know, I'm really pushing it because I'm talking to you now. You need to talk to your parents first. Okay. Well, they said that I should just forget it. Well, I've got to talk to them before I talk to you.
It's kind of scary that parents' ideas were just forget it. But I guess it's, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know how to fix this. I don't know how to make it right. Just stop talking about it and it's not a problem anymore. Is that kind of the ostrich head in the sand philosophy that people are taking?
With some of them.
Oof. What a shame.
Which, again, you know, I guess it comes back to people are going to do the best that they can do. And if that's, you know, I can't tell them how to live their lives. I don't think that's fair of me. I don't think that's fair of me to say, well, you really need to let because I'm not the parent, you know. So that's their choice. And it bothers me, of course, because this kid wants to talk to me, but I can't when they turn 18, you know.
The future for us in the way people treat each other and these bullies, do you think we're going to keep seeing more and more of these cases where they're going to try to sue somebody, they're going to try to point the blame, we're going to try to get somebody to be culpable for the actions of somebody else in a broken state?
I don't know. I think what we're going to do is we're going to start attempting to apply definitions, you know, because it has been going on for some time. Okay, what exactly is bullying? Okay, well, this school and this district says bullying is this. Yet this district over here says, no, it's this. We need to come up with an overall definition. And we need to hold kids and adults accountable for, as you said, the people standing around cheering it on. Even if it's just a sit-down educational something for these kids. Now, herein lies another problem. These schools are overworked, underfunded. Where are we going to find the time and money for that when we, you know, these kids, these schools are buying the school supplies for these kids out of the teacher's own pockets? You know, and there's barely enough time during the day to teach the test and get all these other things that we were responsible for. But
what did this, I mean, 3 years of your life you poured into the research for this book. What was your takeaway? What was, you know, your feel when you got done with this? It's probably different than a serial killer or, you know, passion murder. What did this leave you feeling?
The biggest thing I learned from all of this is that bullying can't just be defined as a mean kid picking on a weak kid in a schoolyard. Bullying has a wide term. It could be a couple of office. Let me try it again. It could be several people in the office giving someone else in the office a very hard time about something. It could be a system, i.e., you know, a school system, coming down hard on the staff about what they're doing wrong and what they better do if they want to keep their jobs. It could be a family in the family system, you know, bullying one of the family members because they're not going along with everyone else on something, i.e. the elephant in the room, and one person in the family says there's a big elephant in the room and the rest of the family just attacks them. Bullying doesn't just mean the kids in the schoolyard. And that's the biggest thing I learned from this.
I can't thank you enough. I mean, it's a hell of a story to involve yourself in and to go through. And I got to guess this was kind of an emotional roller coaster for you because, again, not only are you doing the story and researching a very tragic suicide, but then hearing from other kids that are in different mental states that are kind of crying out for help in their own way, that's got to really have impacted and changed you as well.
I talk to a lot of kids who mental illness, suicide, self-mutilation, parents in prison, it was all just the norm. They talked about it like going to the prom or taking a math test. It was just the norm. It was just something that just happened. I talked to kids who had scars in their arms and legs from cutting. You know, it looked like, I can't even explain it. It was just straight lines going all the way down their lower arm or leg. And brave kids.
Mm-hmm.
because they actually talked about it and showed it to me and said, I want to help.
Heartbreaking. Make the change, folks. Read the book, Bullied to Death, A Story of Bullying, Social Media, and the Suicide of Cherokee Harriman. Judith A. Yates, our guest, and we'll have links up to her book. You can find it again by going to darknessradio.com. Click on our Killer Deals link. You'll find that book and all the other great books we cover here on the show and on our paranormal series. So make sure you check that out for yourself. Judith, thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening and being here.
Thank you so much. Y'all be safe out there.
Will do. You too. All right. Let's try to lighten the mood a little bit. We'll crack open the case files. It's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Well, Tim, I don't know that I can even say that these first two stories are dumb crimes. They're definitely bizarre.
Okay.
This is, I don't know. There's got to be a crime involved here. Russian woman was embalmed alive in a deadly hospital mistake.
Ouch.
Yeah, a Russian woman was embalmed alive when doctors unwittingly put her on a formaldehyde-based drip instead of saline during a surgery, according to a report. Ekaterina Fedoreva, age 27, died from the gruesome medical blunder, in which her veins were pumped full of the chemical, which is generally used to prevent the decomposition of corpses, according to the UK Sun. This is pure murder, said her mother, Galina. According to the paper, it was simply eroding her body from the inside. Fedieva was getting a routine surgery at a hospital last month in Russia when doctors placed her on a formaldehyde drip, which can also be used as a disinfectant, the paper reported. She suffered pain and convulsions for 2 days before falling into a coma and being rushed to a hospital in Moscow, her mom said, according to the paper. Her legs were moving. She had convulsions. Her whole body was shaking. I put socks on her, then a robe, then a blanket, but she was shivering so much that I cannot even begin to describe it. Fedieva was attached to a life support machine, but she eventually died of heart and lung failure, according to the paper. Her mother claims that doctors knew something was wrong, but they refused to help her. People who performed the surgery already knew that they infused something wrong, she said. They needed to take some urgent measures, but they did nothing. I begged, please help her. She is my only child. A doctor eventually copped to the horrifying flub, admitting it wasn't normal saline, but they put formalin in her. Fedieva was buried on April 7th. A criminal investigation is underway, the paper reported. The name of the hospital where the medical flub took place was not immediately clear. So they kill somebody by giving them not a saline drip, Tim, but formaldehyde. How would you – do you have those on the wrong shelves? I mean, I've seen Russian writing. It can be very confusing, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But saline, formaldehyde.
Yeah, you would think the spellings wouldn't be similar in Russian.
No, no.
Yeah.
No, but as long as we're talking gruesome –
mm-hmm.
A woman has been arrested for beheading her boyfriend, then asks the cops to let me get my heads. A West Virginia woman was arrested for beheading her boyfriend before telling cops, you have to take me back and let me get my heads. Tim, heads.
No.
As they drove her away from the bloody scene, authorities said, a judge in Mercer County said further assessment is needed to evaluate the mental competency of Rowena Cheryl Mills, who is charged with second-degree murder in the death of 29-year-old Bo Allen White. That's what WVNS is reporting. Mills, according to court documents obtained by a station, was found covered in blood while wearing a glove on her left hand when deputies responded on April 1st to a home in Eden Valley Road in Lorona. Using a fake name, Mills, age 41, told responding deputies she was cut and left bloodied after being thrown through a glass door. She then got combative with officers and was placed under arrest. Once inside a deputy's cruiser, Mills reportedly said, "You have to take me back and let me get my heads." Later that day, cops were tipped off to the decapitated body of a man found on another block in the same town. A different, unidentified part of his body was also found, where Mills was arrested, WVNS is reporting. The killing, according to the criminal complaint, was a decapitation homicide, Mercer County prosecuting attorney George Silter said. That's how it appears. A court-ordered mental status evaluation will determine if Mills can face trial in White's brutal death. The case will then be presented to a grand jury in June. If 12 of 16 grand jurors find probable cause in the alleged killing, Mills will be indicted either on a first or second degree murder charge, according to the prosecutor, even though she's only been initially charged with second degree murder because there was some initial doubt about premeditation. The grand jury could certainly indict her on first degree murder, Stilter told the station. Mills of Rural Retreat, Virginia, remained in custody at the Southern Regional Jail in Raleigh on $210,000 cash-only bail as of Monday. That's what the jail records are showing, Tim. While in custody at the jail, Mills, who was dating White, according to his father, had been talking about killing someone, employees told WVNS. Deputies were called to the second home after its owners saw someone suspicious in their driveway, a glove matching one that Mills was wearing at the time, was found earlier at White's home, according to the station.
Mm.
I want to go back and get my heads. That's more than one, Tim.
Yeah, that doesn't show very good mental competency.
Well, no, it makes me wonder if she's done this before.
Yeah, I think she has.
You think so?
Yeah, more than once, yeah. Would say many.
I'm not going into Florida quite yet, Tim. I've been in Canada for a few days, and I just want to stay away from Florida as long as I can. But, oh, don't worry. Fear not, my faithful friend. Canada is waiting for us, sadly.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
I've got a bunch of short stories to share tonight, Tim.
Okay.
These are short, to the point, short and sweet, dumb crimes. We're going to Peoria, Illinois. Stabbed in the gut, a Peoria County woman blamed her sister, who in turn blamed a ham-cutting accident, police say. At about 8:30 p.m. Thursday, Peoria County Sheriff's deputies were called regarding a stabbing at a residence. Just west of Peoria's western city limit, deputies arrived to find a resident, Carolyn Carpenter, age 48, standing in the driveway holding her stomach, according to the police report. Two puncture wounds were visible to her abdomen, the report stated. As Carpenter was loaded into the ambulance, she said she had been on the second floor of the dwelling, arguing with her sister, who stabbed her twice, the report stated. Without offering specifics, Carpenter said the only reason for the stabbing would be that her sister was jealous of her, the report said. Upstairs, the deputies found a wood-handled pocket knife on a dresser and apparent blood droplets on the carpet, the report said. The sister, Anna John Carpenter, 49, who also lives at the residence, told deputies that the stabbing was nothing more than just an accident, Tim. She says, "I was cutting up my ham when she ran into my knife. Twice." Asked to describe the knife used, Anna John Carpenter described the same pocket knife recovered from atop the dresser. A deputy wrote in the report, "Note that while speaking to both Carolyn and Anna John, I detected a strong odor of an alcoholic beverage emitting from their mouths." Three other people had been inside the home at the time of the stabbing. All said they saw nothing. A woman was stabbed twice, or a ham sandwich was being cut. Either way, nobody saw nothing, Tim.
That's one bloody ham sandwich, Dave.
Mm-hmm. Anna John Carpenter was transported to the Peoria County Jail and booked on charges of aggravated domestic battery and aggravated battery. Carolyn Carpenter was taken to a Peoria hospital, but information about her injury or condition has not yet been made available. Mm-hmm. It's one hell of a ham sandwich. Is that ham straight off the pig? I mean, how tough was it that you're cutting your sandwich and you end up hacking up your sister?
Well, yeah, sometimes it gets a little frustrating when you get that tough ham from the store, Dave, and you got to take it out somewhere. At least that's what the court case will state. Yeah.
Have you ever, Tim, gone to 7-Eleven and gotten a Slurpee?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, love it.
Aren't they just truly one of God's gifts to planet Earth, the Slurpee?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I remember, Tim, I remember getting up early and biking down to 7-Eleven with my 59 cents. Yeah, that's how old I am, Tim. I remember getting a Slurpee for 59 cents.
Wow.
Oh, and I would mix the blue and the red, Tim. And I would go down there, especially on Marvel Comics Cup Day. Do you remember Marvel Comics Cup Day, Tim?
Well, we only had one 7-Eleven in like a 30-mile radius, so I would go every once in a great while.
Did you ever see? Well, they used to have Marvel characters that had come out every couple of years on their cups. And you'd go down and you'd buy the plastic cup, and then you'd fill it up with that delicious red and blue nectar. Sometimes Coke. Mm-hmm. Sometimes Coke-flavored, Tim. They were rebellious back then.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved it. And there was nothing more disheartening than getting all the way there to find out one of two things, Tim. The Slurpee machine was down, or that they were out of Marvel cups, Tim.
Yeah.
And then, like Mount Vesuvius of Illinois, I would begin to rumble, Tim. I would feel my blood boil within my veins. And the only thing that could quench that heat, Tim, the only possible thing that could bring the temperature down from the rage that was building within me would have been one sip of that sweet, icy gold, Tim. Maybe even just a scoop of it on that specially designed straw with the little spoon on the end. You know what I'm talking about, Tim, don't you? Slurpee spoon.
Oh, sure.
God, I loved it. So I understand when somebody gets mad at 7-Eleven, Tim. And there was a woman that's been charged, Tim, for threatening to blow up a Virginia Beach 7-Eleven. She, speaking of Marvel Comics, she looks like a villain from a DC comic book.
Really?
I don't know how to explain this. And I'm not picking on her, folks. I'm not picking on. So if you are born with, what some would deem unappealing, unattractive looks, I would never pick on you for that. But this woman tattooed like tears going down her face and what appears to maybe be a dragon on her cheek. Maybe like a red push start button between her eyes. And then she's got dark raccoon eye makeup on. I'm not quite sure what I'm looking at, Tim, to be honest with you. Virginia Beach, Virginia is where we're going, though. Virginia Beach woman has been charged with threatening to blow up a 7-Eleven near the Bayside area. Oh, God, not near Bayside, Tim. Screech and Slater and Zach and Kelly, and they could all be in trouble if Bayside blows up, Tim.
Oh, yeah, they could.
That was California, I guess. So they're saved by the bell on that. Virginia Beach Fire Department spokesman Art Cohn says 33-year-old Crystal Mostek walked into a store on the Pleasure House Road around 8:30 p.m. Wednesday, placed a device on the counter, and told the clerk it was a bomb. Cohn says Mostek threatened to blow up the store. It was later determined the device was, in fact, not a bomb, Tim. Mostek is being held at the Virginia Beach City Jail on felony charges of threatening to bomb and possession of a hoax device. That's a new that's a new thing. I've never heard of that. I've heard of drug paraphernalia.
Mm-hmm.
But you can be arrested for having possession of a hoax device. So if I have like a black box with a switch on it and a red light, is that a hoax device for a bomb?
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
Yeah, she's single, Tim. I could send her your name and address. I don't know. Maybe you're willing to rehabilitate her. Maybe she just needs the love of a good man, Tim. And if one's not available, there's you.
Well, I would pass. I got a lawn to mow somewhere.
A lawn to mow. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. She might be able to help you, Tim. She looks sturdy. She looks like a plowing woman, if you know what I mean. Like you could just strap her up. And she could plow the back 40 for you, Tim.
Sturdy, you say? You know, in relation to that, Dave, did you hear the story about the Green Bay Packers wide receiver who got arrested?
Wait, is this a joke? Hey, Dave, did you hear about the Green Bay Packer receiver that got arrested? No. Are you being serious? What happened?
He got arrested at LAX for making a joke about a bomb in his luggage.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He made a joke about a bomb being in his luggage, and he was detained and then arrested for making a joke about it.
Yeah, maybe he was just bragging up, man, my new luggage is the bomb. You know, maybe it's a good Samsonite with a hard shell or something. No?
No.
Straight up just said there was a bomb in there, huh?
Yeah, said there was a bomb in his luggage. He was making a joke about it, and they arrested him.
Prior to 9/11, Tim, my dad, my Uncle Bob, and my dumbass cousin Joe. I will not say his last name to protect the innocent. It's not Schrader. He's not a blood relative. Can I just go on record as saying that, Tim?
Sure.
They're in line at the airport. They're about to go through security. And the security agent says, whose bag is this? And my cousin Joe chirps up and says, well, isn't that your bag, Uncle Jimmy, the one with the bomb in it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were detained a little bit that afternoon, Tim. My dad and uncle were not happy campers.
See, I did that. I got to admit, when I was young and dumb and in college, I did that when we dropped Teddy. And I know you think Teddy's dead, but he's not
God
dead.
Bless him. We miss you, Teddy.
No, he's alive. He's fully alive.
In our hearts, he'll always be alive.
No, he's really alive. He's in Wisconsin. You should say
hi. He's being dead, isn't it? Just kidding. Anyway, you go to drop Teddy off at the airport, and what happens?
In La Crosse. We were going to drop a friend off at the airport in La Crosse, and that was back when you could walk somebody up right to their gate.
Back in the good. So you could give them a hug, maybe a little squeeze of the ass on the way up the jetway.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right, sure. And you know, if Teddy needed one, I'd sure give him one.
Why not?
Why not? So we walk our friend up to the gate, and as they put their bags on the little conveyor belt there at La Crosse, it's going through the X-ray machine, and I went, oh, look, a bomb. And mind you, this was in the late 80s, early 90s, and the airport employee looked at me with the most serious look you could ever give somebody and said, we never, ever joke about that. And I went, ooh, okay. Yeah, Tim, I kind of got it.
You don't want to do that. That's a bad thing to do. You know, it's a good follow-up story to my dad and uncle and my dumbass cousin. My dad is kind of hard of hearing, as you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I may have mentioned this on the show. I can't remember, but my mom and dad are going on a trip, and they're going into Canada, and it's late, and they're crossing the border, and my dad does not hear well, and the window goes down, and the border agent looks in and goes, do you have any drugs or alcohol or illegal weapons to declare? My dad goes, yep, and this guy's jaw just hits open, and my mom looks over and hits my dad, and she goes, hey, dumbass, he asked you if you have any guns, alcohol, or drugs. And my dad looks at him and goes, oh, no. She goes, he's hard of hearing, but he doesn't like to admit it. So he's just like, oh, yeah. He thought they were just saying, oh, are you coming into Canada? Yeah. No, he told them that he had drugs. And the guy looks at my mom and looks at my dad and starts laughing and just waves them on. First of all, that's scary in itself.
Yeah.
You know, when we were at the height of doing all of our live events and we were going, you know, to the Stanley Hotel or Queen Mary, my friend Chris Fleming, well, your friend too, I guess. I'll share him with you, Tim. Our friend Chris Fleming, the paranormal investigator who kind of introduced the K2 meter to the paranormal community, he was selling these little ghost meters, and he had asked me if I'd be willing to bring, because a shipment came in, he asked me if I'd bring them. So I had them all in a duffel bag. And, you know, here's an important tip. If you have items that have 9-volt batteries in them, just leave the batteries at home and get 9 volts wherever you're going. I guess 9-volt batteries are what are commonly used in detonator devices for bombs.
Yes, they are. Yep.
And through the machine goes my bag. And all of a sudden, the bag system stops. The red light starts going. And they're waving over every cop available. And I'm like, oh, God, somebody's in trouble. And then they yank my bag out. They go, whose bag is this? And I'm like, oh, crap, it's mine. I go, it's mine. They take me over, and he goes, what's in this bag, sir? I take a deep breath, and I go, ghost hunting tools. And they all just stop and look at each other, and he goes, come again? I said, those are ghost hunting tools. They're the ghost meter, the K2 meter. And so they slowly unzip this duffel bag, right? Mm-hmm. And they peel back the lid, and they're like all holding their breath. They pull back the lid, and there's all of these white boxes with Chris Fleming with, you know, he's got his picture on there with these kind of bright lights behind him, and he's looking all mystical. And they look at him, and the guy goes, huh, they're ghost hunting equipment. Okay, sir. And he zips the bag up, hands it to me, and he goes, have a good trip.
Jeez.
So, Tim, I could have smuggled a bomb aboard the plane and just told them it was a ghost hunting equipment. And that was the end of what they looked at.
Yeah.
That was a little scary.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I ended up muling for him a few more times. And sometimes they never stopped me. Sometimes I would get the full pat-down treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That Green Bay Packers wide receiver, his name is Trevor Davis. He was arrested Sunday at LAX for making a bomb threat. The way it happened was that Davis and a female companion were checking in at the Hawaiian Airlines ticket counter Sunday morning when the ticket agent asked them if they had a list of unapproved items like aerosols, knives, or explosives, a standard procedure before checking into a flight.
Mm.
Davis then turned to the companion and, according to Pettigrin, made a statement in the area of, yeah, did you pack the explosives? Yeah.
Well, you know what? Maybe he was saying it sarcastically, like, are you really asking me? And first of all, if I did pack explosives, am I about to tell you? Maybe he just looked at his girlfriend and he's like, yeah, did you pack the explosives?
Exactly what he did.
Oh, is it? So, well, do you think he should go to jail for that?
Well, it says airport police were alerted to the 24-year-old's comments, and he was subsequently arrested on a misdemeanor charge of making a bomb threat. Davis was then booked into an L.A. jail shortly after noon on Sunday, released within the hour on a $15,000 bail on a joke, Dave.
Do you know what he needs?
A joke.
What he needs? He needs Dave Schrader, defense attorney at large.
Get a free ham sandwich when you hire Dave.
I would get him off so quickly, Tim.
You what?
I would get him off. He would be in good hands with me. That's all I got to say. He would be in good hands, and I would get him off fast, Tim.
Well, at least
your head would spin.
Huh?
That your head would spin. That's how fast I would get this guy off. Because again, it's not a bomb threat. He didn't say, "Yeah, we packed a bomb." He turned and asked, "Yeah, did you pack the explosives?" There's nothing they can hold. That's bonkers. That's taking stuff a little too far. And I'm not a Packer fan here, Tim.
Right.
But I'm sure what's going to happen is this guy's going to end up on our team now anyway, here in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Right? Because nobody's going to want him, but Minnesota will be like, oh, we'll take your scraps.
Exactly.
All right, Tim, I've held off as long as I can. We're going to Florida. Fort Pierce.
Okay.
Authorities say a Florida woman is blaming a windy day for the cocaine that police found in her purse. WPLG reported Kenisa Posey was just one of two passengers in a car stopped by Fort Pierce police in late March. Police say an officer smelled the marijuana, Tim, and that after searching the car, cocaine and marijuana in separate bags were found inside a purse Posey had on her lap. Authorities say they questioned Posey about said drugs. According to the police report, Posey responded, "It's a windy day. Must have blown in there through the window and into my purse."
Of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Posey was charged with a felony count of cocaine possession and a misdemeanor count of marijuana possession. She was later released on bond. It wasn't immediately known if she has a lawyer. If she doesn't, she needs to call Dave Schrader, defense attorney at large.
Free cocaine with every hire.
No, it's never free, Tim. I got to charge for that stuff. It's not like it grows on trees, for God's sakes.
Sorry, 20% off your cocaine with every hire.
It blew in her window. Now, I will tell you, again, do you mind if I give you a new follow-up story on that one? I'm off to the airport to go to Toronto, Canada, where I'm at right now, Tim.
Okay.
Yep. And I'm walking through. And I've got this wheelie backpack, and I'm dragging it. And, oh, look, it's cute. They've got this cute kind of middle puppy German Shepherd that's a drug-sniffing dog. And it's walking around. They're like, don't touch the dog. Don't interact with the dog. Just walk normally. Don't try to pet the dog. Just go to your and let the dog do its job. And I'm laughing, and, like, all of a sudden it gets behind one guy, and it's, like, sniffing his shoes like crazy, right?
Uh-oh.
And then it veers off. And the cop looks over at his two partners and he goes, did you guys see that? And they're like, yeah. And I'm starting to laugh to myself. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's like the woman with the cocaine in the back of her bag, right? The wind blew it in. He must have just stepped in some marijuana on the way in to the airport. And then all of a sudden, a horrifying thought crossed my mind, Tim. I like to shop at a very, very prestigious boutique, the G-Dub, Tim. Some call it the Goodwill. I call it the G-Dub. I like to get high-end merchandise at lower prices.
Sure.
And I got this backpack for this trip.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden it hit me. I'm like, you know what I didn't do, Tim? Do you know what I didn't do when I bought this bag? I didn't go through all the pockets, Tim.
Yeah, check it thoroughly, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I didn't go through all the pockets. And then I would be one of those guys, hey, this isn't even my bag. But you know what? I knew that I had the receipt for the bag from Goodwill. Do you think that would get me enough out of trouble?
No, you'd still be in possession, though.
Yeah, but even if it wasn't mine, it's not mine, officer. It blew into my bag. Well, I wonder if this next guy can use this exact same excuse, Tim, because if a father forgot, he put his gun in his son's backpack, and he was arrested for what he did next, Tim.
Okay.
We're going to the Miami area, Tim. As a Miami father left his home Thursday morning to take his 8-year-old son to Kendall Elementary, he put his pistol in the boy's backpack, then forgot about the weapon, police said. But instead of calling authorities, Ramon Nuri walked into the school and asked administrators to summon the boy with the bag. Inside the office, Nuri fished the gun out of the bag, put it in his waistband, and left the school, according to an arrest report. Yeah, that wouldn't scare many people, right? Especially after what just took place? No, that's a good solid plan, father. Nuri, age 53, was arrested and charged Thursday with possessing a weapon on school grounds, improper exhibition of a weapon, and possession of a concealed firearm. He was booked into jail late Thursday. A terrified parent who saw Nuri take the weapon out of the bag notified school officials, who then called Miami-Dade School Police. Detectives reviewed surveillance footage, which confirmed the account. Police arrested Nuri on Thursday afternoon when he came to pick up the boy at Kendall School. He confessed, according to the arrest report by Miami-Dade School's Detective John Messenger, and the gun was found inside the car. The arrest report did not say whether Nuri admitted why he put the weapon in the book bag to begin with. So, you know, I don't claim to be the greatest dad in the world, Tim. I've made my fair share of mistakes. No. It's true. No, it's true. But among those mistakes, Tim, I can honestly say I've never hidden a gun in my 8-year-old's backpack. That just seems to me wrought with all kinds of possible peril.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know.
You don't have much to say.
Probably
on the
not
story.
The smartest thing. I do. It's probably not great parenting. But,
no.
Yeah.
Well, let's go, as long as we're here in Florida, if you don't mind, Tim, we're just going to take a trek down the road to Orange County, Florida, where a man wearing a clown mask and another wearing a Jason Voorhees mask robbed an Orange County Chevron gas station Friday morning, deputies said. Authorities said the two men had initially walked into the gas station without masks, then returned wearing them and demanded cash from the clerk. Deputies said the clerk complied with the demands and the armed robbers. The pair fled the Aloma Avenue gas station in a gold Jaguar, Tim. No injuries were reported. Detectives said they believe the unmasked surveillance photos are of the same culprits who committed the robbery. So here's the funny thing. If you're going to go hold a place up and then take off in a car, do you think maybe you'd use a car that's not quite as, I don't know, noticeable?
Flashy?
Say a gold, first of all, a gold any kind of car, but a gold Jaguar might stand out.
Sometimes the best camouflage, Dave, is to hide in open sight.
Well, and these two dumbass kids wore the same shirts earlier when they went into the place, and they're the same build, same shirt, same shoes, everything, and all they did was put on masks and came back.
Yeah, that's a little too open, yeah.
This is like all the rage now, Tim. This is what all the kids are saying. A man yells, "Come at me, bro," while stealing beer from a Murray gas station. It's a pair of gas station thieves, Tim, going on. But this one takes place in Murray, Utah. A man is accused of stealing beer from a Murray convenience store at gunpoint and trying to steal a person's car. Police said that Alex R. Payan Martinez walked into the Maverick store. He was caught on surveillance video grabbing a case of beer, raising a semi-automatic handgun to the customer and employee and saying, "Come at me, bro!" A few hours later, Unified Police responded to a carjacking where an officer recognized the suspect as the same person caught on video robbing the convenience store. Officers said Payan Martinez later admitted to robbing the convenience store. He was booked for aggravated robbery. All right, Tim, our final couple of stories here. Would you like me to read story number one or story number two, Tim? And that'll become abundantly clear why I'm asking you that way.
I'll go number two, Dave.
Oh, I know you like to. Subway rider smears poop all over train number two, Tim. There are crappy commutes, that's for sure. And then there's this. A strap hanger in New York took the name of the number two train a little too seriously and spread feces all over a pair of subway cars during the Monday morning commute, riders and cops said. The train's conductor was alerted to the situation by riders as they pulled into the Borough Hall station in downtown Brooklyn. The conductor then said over the intercom exactly why the train was going out of service. The conductor announced that there were stalled because of a sanitation and hygiene issue, and then said there was feces all over two cars and everyone would have to get off and wait for the next train, said urban planner Sarah Daughtry, who was riding to Manhattan from Atlantic Avenue. I do appreciate the honesty, she says. MTA officials said they were appalled at the incident, Tim. Appalled, I say. We are completely disgusted, and we have no idea why anyone would do this to their fellow New Yorkers, said agency spokesman John Weinstein. The cars were immediately removed from service and cleaned. Police are investigating the incident. And this story is filed under poop and subways, Tim. I kid you not. That is the tag words for them. Poop and subways. Here we go, Tim. Now to the number one story. Police said that urine was found in the library soap dispenser and air freshener. In Ew. Burlington, Massachusetts. Police say someone poured urine into a Massachusetts library bathroom soap dispenser and air freshener. Officials said Friday that library staff had found the urine there March 21st. A library patron had first discovered a separate cup of urine on the men's bathroom shelf at the Burlington Public Library. The library told the police that day, Burlington police are looking for who may be responsible. They're reviewing surveillance footage. And in our final story, Tim, we're going out. Well, we're going out the way nature intended us to, Tim. My rod and my staff, they comfort me in this final story, Tim.
All right.
As I have to face getting back on a plane today. This is the headline. Man sat in an empty row spotted masturbating during a flight in front of horrified passengers. That's right. A man was spotted seemingly masturbating himself while he sat on an empty row during a flight. During footage, it shows the man's hand move rapidly under a blanket while a blissful, unaware woman reclines on a chair reading just inches away. The incident was recorded by another passenger who stands up in his seat and points his camera at the man's face while goading and laughing at him. The man, wearing what looks like a business suit, shirt, and glasses, turns to look at the camera and then starts to studiously examine the mobile phone in his other hand. But the man filming continues to laugh while pointing at the camera at the alleged masturbator. I don't think it's alleged at this point, who appears to grow more and more uncomfortable, and he starts to squirm in his seat. Because there's nothing worse than just trying to, you know, launch one off, Tim, and have people watching you on board a plane. God, how rude. What happened to common courtesy on a plane? If I just want to release the hounds, why do people have to make a big deal about it, Tim? The video is reported to have been filmed in Brazil in February. However, the man shooting the footage, Tim, shooting the footage, speaks in both German and Russian. At first, he encourages the man to keep going in German, but then switches over to the other language, commenting on LiveLeak, where the video was posted, Dwight Wart, and that's why you never use the blankets on a plane.
Ew.
This isn't the only time, though, Tim, that sex acts in airplanes have been in the news recently. Just last week, Tim, a passenger was arrested after stripping naked to watch porn and masturbate in his seat before going on the attack of an air hostess. The 20-year-old student horrified fellow flyers when he removed his clothes during a flight from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, to Dhaka in Bangladesh on Saturday. He went on to watch a porn film while pleasuring himself before repeatedly urinating in his seat. When air hostesses asked him to get dressed, he allegedly attempted to hug and grope them when he walked from his seat to the toilet. Well, at least he was affectionate. He was like, hey, I'm sorry, bygones. Let's just let them be bygones, huh? Give me a hug. But no, the snobby stewardesses refused to take his love, Tim.
I guess.
Well, that's it. Thank God. The world is falling apart, and we get to report on it weekly. That's Tim. I'm Dave. You've been listening to the best in true crime talk radio. Thank you for subscribing and making our lives a little better. And we hope that you're entertained and we make yours a little better as well. We'll be back next week. Until then, be kind, be loving one another, love one another. And for God's sakes, don't film the guy if he's doing it. Just let him have his few moments in the sun. All right, no, that's disgusting. Make sure you call everybody. Hit every alarm. Let everybody know that this man is, shining the dome to the plane, Tim. Is that what they call it nowadays? Shining the dome to the plane?
I think so, yeah.
And then making sure that you stop his and make a failure to launch for this guy. Very disturbing. That's it for True Crime Tuesday. We'll be back again next week right here.